nattering nabobs of negativism. Which is true, but hey, you've got to bring more to the table than that. When I asked my father about Agnew, he said just one word, clown. As I mentioned, I saw many monster movies as a kid. And like Bill Murray's gang, the Ghostbusters, who were ready to believe anyone, I was always ready to believe what was up there on the screen. Dracula, for sure, was not a guy to be messed with. But there were tons of crosses in my house, so he wasn't much of a threat to me. The Invisible Man did not haunt me, I'm not exactly sure why. And Frankenstein's monster was over there in Bavaria someplace, and not likely to book a transatlantic flight anytime soon. It was The Mummy, though, that drove me crazy. In the original 1932 film, Boris Karloff came back to life after some English guys violated the tomb of an ancient Egyptian princess. Okay, fine. I'm buying the curse business that forced Karloff back to life. But here's the problem. The Mummy was slow. Very, very slow. It took him 3 days to do the 100-yard dash. And unlike Dracula, he couldn't hypnotize you with his eyes because they were covered with dusty bandages. Are you getting the picture? So anybody could simply run away from the Mummy. He couldn't catch Mount Rushmore. But every time Boris showed up, his victim just stood there screaming. Didn't try to run away at all. The person just let the Mummy walk up and strangle him. That was insane. I remember loudly saying to my friends during the movie, why doesn't the guy just run away? Other moviegoers shushed me, but it was a legitimate question. All of us should have demanded refunds. Tiny Tim also drove me nuts. Not the Dickens character in The Christmas Carol, but a guy from Brooklyn named Herbert Corey, who showed up on the Johnny Carson program singing a song called Tiptoe Through the Tulips. Corey used the name Tiny Tim and was as revolting a presence as I've ever seen on TV. Strumming a stupid ukulele and showing off long, stringy, unkempt hair, the tiny guy was a train wreck. But Carson loved him and made him a star, at least for the year 1968. As you may remember, Tiny married a woman called Miss Vicky on Carson's program, capping off as bizarre a career as has ever been seen in this country. By the way, about 40 million Americans viewed the unbelievably hyped wedding, more even than watched The Factor. Not much better was the Beverly Hillbillies. Again, inexplicable. This program, along with Green Acres and Gilligan's Island, insulted the word dumb. But for some reason, millions of Americans could not stop watching. I can't explain this, and it has disturbed me since childhood. See, most of the time, I really do understand why things happen in our culture. In matters of entertainment, individual tastes obviously rule. For example, I like the Bee Gees, because to me, their tunes and harmonies are pleasing. But lots of folks hate the Brothers Gibb, believing their songs to be trite. I can relate to that, but obviously trite doesn't much bother me. On the other hand, I could never listen to a group like Metallica, not for a minute, but millions of folks like the heavy metal stuff, and I have no problem with that. Every person hears sound in a unique way, but let's face it, there is no excuse for a group called the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, whose first single, Simon Says, rose to number 2 in 1968, a cultural tragedy if there ever was one. In 1970, I walked out of a movie called Love Story. It was just too much. Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neal, madly infatuated, mouthing lines like, love means never having to say you're sorry. Awful. And what does that mean exactly? I step on your foot and don't apologize because I'm in love? Oh, I stepped on your toes, madam. Forgive me. I can't apologize. I made out with Ally McGraw last night and can never apologize for anything ever again. Back then, the ladies at Vassar College were buying this love story stuff big time. But the thugs living with me at Marist College were having none of it. In fact, any guy who liked Love Story was immediately mocked and scorned beyond belief. To Marist's everlasting honor, approving of Love Story was a campus career breaker. Later, I learned that Al Gore, a student at Harvard when Love Story author Eric Segal taught there, may have been the inspiration for the lead character. And even though Al was rumored to have embraced the Love Story speculation, it is brutally unfair to him because I believe all the hot air spewed in that movie was the beginning of the global warming crisis, and I resent that very much. Perhaps the worst movie I have ever seen was Moment to Moment, a 1978 bomb starring John Travolta and Lily Tomlin. Moment to Moment makes Love Story look like Citizen Kane. For mental health reasons, I've tried to block the movie out of my mind, but I do remember Miss Tomlin, 15 years Travolta's senior, getting into a hot tub with him. Was Ruth Buzzy not available? Anyway, Travolta was wearing a Speedo and Lily was, well, appreciating him. All I can say is that this was not a high point in the history of heterosexuality. Also, I kept wondering what the Welcome Back Kotter guys, the Sweat Hogs, would say. A few years later, Travolta starred in another hydrogen bomb called Perfect. In this one, he and Jamie Lee Curtis work out in a health club and fall in love amid the free weights. I kept waiting for someone to say love means never having to do aerobics, but it never happened. In fact, nothing ever happened in that movie, unless you count Jamie Lee perspiring in skin-tight gym clothes, which, believe me, is no small thing. After the Perfect embarrassment, Travolta did not make another film for 4 long years. Then, in 1989, he made a comeback with a baby movie called Look Who's Talking. Good for him. Even though he has a definite karma debt for Moment to Moment and Perfect, I'm glad the guy made it back. It is truly a mystery of the universe as to how some movies get made. These days, few Americans even bother going to the theater unless they want to keep their little kids quiet with a dose of Shrek. Hollywood moguls, understanding that computers provide a vast array of at-home entertainment for Americans, now make most movies for people in Bangladesh. That explains the return of Rambo. Looking back during the late 1960s and early 70s, there were unexplained expositions nearly every day. For example, in the fall of 1967, a song called Incense and Peppermints hit number one. The group that sang the song was called Strawberry Alarm Clock. What does that name mean? Why not call the group Cinnamon Raisin Toast? I mean, people were so fried back then that anything was acceptable as long as it was far out. My theory is that folks got so fed up with the 1960s psychedelic rock that in desperation they turned to disco. Tell me that listening to Vanilla Fudge or Iron Butterfly won't make you crazy after a while. So with Insanity in the Wind, Saturday Night Fever arrived on the scene. Actually, that blockbuster 1977 movie, starring the aforementioned John Travolta, was an excellent depiction of working-class Brooklyn in those days. I completely understand the film's success. But the societal craze it spawned requires some deep thought, some of it very painful. No question that some disco tunes were catchy and vibrant. And take it from me, it was fun to go out and make a complete fool of yourself on the dance floor. Thus, at the height of the disco craze in the late 1970s, you had college graduates actually singing along with KC and the Sunshine Band. That's the way, I like it. That's the way, I like it. If you buy the album, you'll hear that chorus at least 97 times in the course of the song. Can you explain that to me? The disco era crashed and died in the mid-80s, but not before Donna Summer, the Village People, and KC burned their images into the fabric of America. Go to any wedding reception today and say hello to them for me. Hands down, the worst song I have ever heard, and that includes the Sloopster, is the Willie Nelson Julio Iglesias atrocity to all the girls I've loved before. Arrest warrants should have been sworn out immediately after that turkey hit the marketplace. In the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that I interviewed Willie Nelson way back in 1977. As a young reporter in Dallas, I was sent out to get his take on something or other. I can't remember exactly what. However, I do recall that during the interview, which took place on his bus, Nelson smoked pot and waved a pistol around. That didn't faze me much, but it was weird, no question. Anyway, in 1984, Nelson and Iglesias, a rather smarmy Latin ballad singer, put out the song that congratulates women on sleeping with them. The big line in the recording is, "We're glad they came along." Now, I'm no feminist or anything, but That sounds just a wee bit condescending, does it not? We're glad they came along. Just for laughs, run that by some ladies and see how they react. Yet, incredibly, the song hit number one on the country chart and spent 3 months on the pop chart, peaking at number five. If there's a bigger mystery in the universe, please let me know. But wait, I might have found a bigger one. In 1980, Willie Nelson appeared in a movie called Honeysuckle Rose, along with actress Diane Cannon. At the time, Miss Cannon was 43 years old and a great-looking woman. I didn't see the film, but I understand that Diane, who was once married to Cary Grant, and Nelson actually hooked up romantically. The only thing I can figure out is that the movie studios mixed up Honeysuckle Rose and Moment to Moment. It was supposed to be Diane Cannon romancing John Travolta and Lily Tomlin with Willie Nelson. Now, that might sound unfair to Miss Tomlin, but there is no other credible explanation. Currently, there are many cultural mysteries still in play. For one, I know people who can watch 6 hours of American Idol a week. They call one another and talk about some girl from Rhode Island who sings Respect and then gets heckled by Simon Cowell. Again, if anyone can explain this, please write. Dancing with the Stars is big, too. Once a guy named Tucker Carlson appeared on that program and did the Mambo or something. Carlson is a political commentator on TV who has not been very successful. I watched Carlson dancing on that program. This tape should be airlifted to Guantanamo Bay for interrogation use. You may know that a rapper named Snoop Dogg has made millions of dollars. He used to call himself Snoop Doggy Dogg, but dropped the doggy. No one knows why. One of his big hits includes the phrase, "I wanna do something freaky to you." Actually, I've never heard the song, but the lyric sounds great, doesn't it? Nat King Cole, I'm sure, would have loved it. By the way, Mr. Dogg's mom appeared on The Factor. Nice woman. She said that her son, whose given name is Calvin Broadus Jr., is nice to her. Beyond that, she can't imagine why he's been arrested so many times, but believes it might be a misunderstanding of some kind. Vice President Dick Cheney is a complete mystery to me. I interviewed him way back in 1990, and that was that. He would never again consent to be interviewed by the Bold Fresh guy. During my one chat with Cheney, I pushed him on why the press didn't like him. In fact, the press despises Cheney so much, they'd rather dine with the late Idi Amin. Cheney would not concede the loathing. The main problem with Cheney, and to a lesser extent with President Bush, is that they rarely explain themselves to we the people. When Iraq went south, Cheney went hunting. Not very responsible, since he was one of the prime Get Saddam guys. He should have been out there explaining what the hell was going on. But he didn't. The result? His MIA status allowed NBC News and the New York Times to define the Iraq issue. Disastrous. Also not fair to the brave men and women fighting in that conflict. And not fair to their families here at home. Cheney should have stood up. Call me crazy, but I'd like all elected officials to be stand-up guys and gals. If you make a mistake, admit it. If the going gets tough, explain. Cheney essentially hid out for 8 years in his lavish Washington residence and now will retire to his lavish Wyoming residence with a handsome pension paid for by you and me. We deserved more for our money. By the way, I've sat close to Dick Cheney at 2 Washington dinners. He is a smart and witty man, but he's kept that very secret, hasn't he? Another mystery. Will someone please explain why ultra-fortunate entertainment people abuse the regular folks who have made them rich and famous? This is an amazing phenomenon, and the two best examples of it are Seinfeld and The Sopranos. You may remember that in the final episode of Seinfeld, the wacky cast wound up in some small-town jail. It was not funny. After 9 years of clever writing and brilliant comedic acting, Seinfeld's closing act rivaled Petticoat Junction in witty payoff. So what the heck happened? Since I'm pretty sure I understand the deep cynicism of head writer Larry David and also the middling cynicism of Jerry Seinfeld himself, I think these guys tanked the final episode on purpose. Perhaps they were simply tired of all the show-closing hype and went out to lunch. The last show is definitely a big whatever. There is no other explanation, especially if you acknowledge what could have happened. Using Johnny Carson's brilliant last program as a model, all the Seinfeld people had to do was assemble the cast for a one-hour Best Moments special. Just let the characters kick it around, telling viewers what mattered to them and why, and then roll in the clips. Give the folks some inside baseball as to how the show came together each week, and then wrap it up with some bloopers. David and Seinfeld could have outlined that slam dunk show in 10 minutes. Instead, they produced a dud final episode that the scriptwriters for My Mother the Car would have rejected. The Sopranos was even worse. Here we had a multi-week story arc that viewers closely followed. Millions of people invested their time and were looking forward to some kind of resolution and payoff in the last episode. If you're a fan of the program, you know that low-level gangster Tony Soprano, played brilliantly by James Gandolfini, was a ruthless but not totally evil criminal, a complicated man who many viewers thought about even after the episodes ended. So after 7 seasons on the air, expectations of the show's climax were running incredibly high. Would the feds get Tony? Would other mobsters take him out? Would his family be harmed? What would finally happen to the big guy? Nothing. That's what. The producer of The Sopranos, David Chase, totally punted. In the final scene, Tony and his family were eating at some New Jersey diner while an ominous-looking guy glared at them from across the restaurant. Fade to black. Fade to stupid. I was outraged, and I believe I was not alone. I sat there in my living room wanting to take out a contract on Mr. Chase. But hey, I was stupid as well. I expected the creative minds behind Seinfeld and The Sopranos to consider the expectations of the audience. After all, as I noted earlier, it is those people who make people like Jerry Seinfeld, Larry David, David Chase, and their cast members rich and famous. How about looking out for the folks and giving them an enjoyable send-off? Forget it. Perhaps I'm wrong, but I believe what happened on Seinfeld and The Sopranos demonstrates a condescending contempt for the audience that is common in Hollywood. What other explanation is there? All the producers had to do was test the final episodes for a selected group of viewers, commonly done in the TV industry, and they could have instantly found out they were not delivering the goods. But I believe they knew that from the jump. Those people are smart. They just didn't care. Of course, these are only TV programs, and they don't really matter much in the big scheme of things. But what these guys did was not fair to the audience. Fair. Now, there's an interesting concept. Fair is the reason I'm even discussing Seinfeld and The Sopranos. You see, imposing a sense of fairness on the world is what drives me in my profession and basically in my life. And the same might even be true for you. Chapter 15, and Justice for All. Life is not fair. Universal parental mantra. So we've come this far, and I appreciate your patience with my ramblings. Because the Pew Research Organization and others have stated that my viewers, listeners, and readers are generally well-informed and educated, by now you have undoubtedly picked up a central theme in this book. I do not like to see people treated unfairly, including me. And I will use my power to right what I perceive as wrongs. Of course, many people do not see the wrongs that I see because they don't see the world the way I do. All of us should feel very sorry for those people. At some time, every kid in the world feels his or her parents are being unfair. That usually happens after the parent prevents the kid from putting the cat in the microwave. The kid, of course, means no harm, but at 4 years old, little Ashley may not completely understand the consequences of her actions. Like me, I'm sure you occasionally whine to your folks about the unfairness factor. Actually, I didn't do it all that much, because in my house it was a road to nowhere. My father was proud of being unfair. If I felt his regulations were not in my best interest, he wasn't bothered in the least. In fact, he often wouldn't even have the conversation. When I approached him with some complaint, he'd listen for about 20 seconds and then either leave the room without comment or simply say, "Can't help you." Okay. But once in a rare while, when I actually had put together a cogent argument, my father would revise family policy. I can't exactly recall an incident where that actually happened, but my mother swears it did. School was another story. Their fairness was constantly debated, and the nuns, like President Bush, were the deciders of justice. This was not good. Take my big fight with Tommy M. in the sixth grade. I can't exactly remember what sparked the fracas, but it had been brewing. Tommy was a teacher's pet, and I was a miniature John Dillinger. I did not like Tommy's coziness with our teacher, Mrs. Boyle, and he objected to my objection. A bad moon was definitely rising. When it came, the fight was fierce. Real punches were thrown, shirts were ripped, blood was drawn. This was shocking at St. Bridget's School, since most playground confrontations were foolish exercises in pushing and name-calling. You're a clod! I know you are, but what am I? With material like that, most combatants quickly drifted into a deflated state, and the conflict harmlessly petered out. But this dust-up with Tommy was a far different story. It was nasty. Mrs. Boyle, an elderly woman whose heavily made-up face resembled that of Phyllis Diller, was appalled and angered upon seeing me and Tommy stumble into the classroom after round 10. She immediately sent us to the principal's office, where we were to be judged by a feared nun named Sister Thomasine, no relation to Sister Thomas, who I mentioned in Chapter 5. But the good sister had a problem. Tommy's father, a doctor, was a big-time donor to the church. Punishing his kid, a straight-A student, would not be easy. I, the bold fresh guy, could be sent to Devil's Island without much consequence, but Sister Thomasine had to be cautious with Tommy. After hearing our sides, the sister announced the verdict. Banishment to the convent, the place where the nuns lived, where piles of busy work would be heaped upon us. But there was one thing further. Tommy got just one day of convent hell, while I received 2 days for previous violations, the sister stated. Outrage gripped me. I had already been punished for those previous violations. After watching Perry Mason, I knew this was double jeopardy or something. But above all, it wasn't fair. Upon hearing the verdict, Clement rose to my defense and in no uncertain terms, publicly condemned the sentence, throwing in something about Jesus not liking it as well. That outburst got Clem sent to the convent along with Tommy and me. Thinking back, I believe that's what Clement had in mind all along. Now, you have to picture this. The nuns who taught at St. Bridget's School lived in an old stone convent on Post Avenue in Westbury. The building is still there. To a dopey sixth grader, it looked big and spooky. When I drive by it today, it looks small and quaint. An ancient nun named Sister Gerardo guarded the convent. She was too old to teach, so she stayed in the stone building all day, and I assume prayed diligently for bad boys like me. When Tommy, Clem, and I showed up for detention, the old sister just stared and mumbled something about behaving. Sure. Sister Gerardo quickly assigned us to our punishment desks, which were sensibly located in separate rooms. There, mountains of math problems and composition stuff lay awaiting our attention. This was bad, real bad. The first day passed slowly and painfully. At 3 p.m, we were released, with Tommy smirking at Clem and me. He was finished with his sanction, but we had another day of solitary confinement. No matter, Clem and I agreed that Tommy would get his down the road. The next day, Sister Gerardo repeated the drill. However, about an hour into the imprisonment, I heard a sharp psst. There in the convent hallway stood Clem. Billy, she's asleep. The nun, she's out. I got up and peeked into a side room down the hall. It was true. Sister Gerardo sat there motionless, head drooping, mind off someplace in the land of Nod. Let's check this place out, Clem whispered. Check this place out? This was the convent where the nuns ate and slept. Nobody checked that out. They'll kill us if we get caught, I said quietly. Clem just laughed. Come on. Creeping along the creepy corridor, Clem and I looked in every room. There was nothing too unusual about the place, a big kitchen, dining room, a couple of parlors, one of which was occupied by the sleepy sister. Then Clem went insane. Let's go upstairs. What? Upstairs to where they sleep? Yeah, come on. Now, once again, you have to picture this. Above all, Catholic school kids were taught strict boundaries. The places where priests and nuns lived were way out of bounds. If what Clem was suggesting was an immortal sin, then nothing was. No way, I said. Billy, come on, nobody will ever find out. Chicken? There it was, the C word. For boys in my circumstance, trial by fire. Chicken. Awful. With grave doubts, I followed Clem up the stairs. Sweating heavily, I remember walking down the narrow hallway and peering into the tiny rooms on both sides. All the doors were open. Inside each one, I saw a small bed, like my sister's, a tall chest of drawers, and a closet. The rooms were pretty much identical. Crucifixes hung over the beds. Jesus was looking directly at me. Okay, we did it. Let's get out of here, I said to Clem. I believe I was pleading. To this day, I have not forgotten the demented gleam that appeared in his eyes. He shook his head no and entered one of the rooms. Let me repeat. He entered one of the rooms where a nun slept. My God. Terrified, I split. I simply spun on my heel and walked quickly but quietly down the stairs and back to my jail desk. Sister Gerarda was still out. A few minutes later, Clement looked into my room, wearing a crazed smile. I didn't want to know. A few hours later, Clem and I were released from captivity by Sister Thomasine, who threatened further pain if we continued to be disruptive. Walking out of the building, Clem began laughing. I saw their underwear. Shocked, I just stared at him. Yeah, it's white. I took some of it out of a drawer and hid it under one of the beds. For one of the few times in my life, I was speechless. What could any 11-year-old kid say? Clement had removed a nun's undergarment from her drawer and hid it under a bed. I believe this was the first time in Catholic school history that a sacrilege like that had ever happened. Slowly, my thought process, such as they were, returned. Look, Clem, don't tell anybody about that, okay? We'll get expelled, and that's just the beginning. My father's face popped into my mind and was quickly replaced by hellfire. Clem didn't answer right away. Terror grew inside me. But then he said the sweetest words in the world. Okay, Billy, I won't tell anybody. And he didn't, as far as I know. But for weeks afterward, every time my mother or father called my name, I jumped. Every time I saw Sister Thomasine, I dive for cover. Paranoia does not even begin to cover this. The great convent caper never came back to bite me. It was one of the few times in my life that I did something untoward and didn't get hammered for it. I never heard anything about any nun's clothing. Maybe Clement made the whole thing up, but I wouldn't bet on it. Eventually, I came to realize that some of the unfairness that I experienced at St. Bridget's was actually fair in a roundabout way. Since all the teachers knew that Clem and I were constantly causing trouble, they obviously felt payback on their part was logical and mostly proportionate. On balance, we did get away with a lot of petty stuff. Think about your own life in this regard. I bet you remember some times when you were treated unfairly. Everybody does. But it's how you handle the unfairness in life that may dictate your success or failure. Dealing effectively with inevitable unfair play is not taught in any classroom, as far as I know, and it should be. Here's my take. It took me years to figure out that there are essentially three ways to handle unfair situations. You can ignore them, as my mother usually did. You can confront them directly, as I often do. Or you can deal with them after the fact using a well-thought-out strategy. Unfortunately, most people take the first route. Even though it may anger them, they accept an unfair situation as inevitable. They hold things inside them. Of course, that breeds resentment and bitterness. But some folks can absorb a lot of punishment, as we all know. But it's not physically or mentally healthy to do that. Deciding to confront unfairness head-on usually leads to a situation. And if you don't have the power to win the fight, you could wind up in the convent, so to speak. That was my signature move. I'd take on the Martinets, who had far more power than I did, and I'd lose. Often, I didn't care. I looked at myself as a crusader for justice, and that was that. To my credit, I was willing to take the hits, since it was my decision to confront that provoked many of them. If I was treated unfairly at a job, I found another job. If somebody was giving me a hard time, they got a hard time right back. Do I regret that strategy? Yes and no. Some conflicts have made me stronger, no question. But had I taken a more patient approach to righting a wrong, I could have won a lot more of those confrontations and saved myself considerable pain. Scores of books like The Art of War will teach you conflict strategy. But for me, the issue of fairness swings both ways. If you want to be treated righteously, then you must be righteous to others. That's true even when it's a pain in the rear to do that. Nobody's perfect, but I strive to be fair for one very compelling reason. I know how it feels to be treated unfairly. If you Google my name, you'll find millions of items, some of them as vile as anything ever said about anybody. I usually ignore them, except when they originate from institutions that actually have power. Then I deal with the situation. See, I know if those people are unfairly attacking me, they'll do the same thing to others who are more vulnerable. And my job is to hold the powerful accountable for their actions. So I do my job. Sometimes, however, there is wisdom in fighting unfairness and injustice with patience, biding your time so that all your options become clear. For example, in the spring of 1985, I was anchoring the news at KATU-TV in Portland, Oregon. The situation was interesting. I had signed a short one-year contract to replace a long-time Oregon anchorman who was retiring. Hoping to attract younger viewers, station management brought in a hotshot from the East Coast and paid him big money. That hotshot was the bold, fresh guy. Predictably, some in the newsroom were not fond of hotshots, and so a kind of station culture war erupted. The younger folks liked my freewheeling style. The old guard detested everything about me. As usual, I didn't try real hard to win anybody over. Then in late spring, a call came from my sister who was living in San Diego. My 62-year-old father had been diagnosed with malignant melanoma, and things looked bad back on Long Island. My sister, a nurse, was pregnant with her first child, so there was no way she could get back home for an extended stay. My mother was lost. I met with the station boss, Tom Dargan, to tell him I had to break the contract and go back home. Really, what else could I do? There was no question that alone, my mother was not going to be able to handle my father's last days. When the announcement of my departure was made, I was stunned by some of the vicious comments. Idiots in the Oregonian newspaper printed anonymous quotes from a few KATU people who claimed that I had been fired. In those accounts, my father's illness was being portrayed as a ruse to cover the mistake of hiring O'Reilly. Of course, nobody would say that with their name attached because they definitely would have been paid a visit by me, and they knew it. Rage does not even begin to describe how I felt, but there was nothing I could do. You can't confront phantoms. So I worked out my final week, swallowing the unfairness. It did not go down well. A few weeks after I get back to New York, my father died at home. At the end, my mother, sister, and I were at his side. The funeral was 3 days later. The ordeal was brutal on my mom. In fact, she never fully recovered. I hung around home that summer, making sure chaos was kept to a minimum so that my mother could deal with her grief without distraction. I took care of the financial stuff and tried in other ways to make her transition as soft as possible. Along the way, things began to happen. Good things. The brass at WCVB-TV in Boston, Jim Coppersmith and Phil Balboni, offered me a challenging job at Channel 5. Also, I had been accepted into Harvard's Kennedy School of Government across the Charles River in Cambridge. So I decided to take a few courses there and work at the same time. Boston is just 200 miles from New York, so getting home on a regular basis wasn't a problem. In addition, my agent, Carol Cooper, had received a letter from KATU. It went as follows. Dear Carol, for the record, I wish to note that we are releasing Bill O'Reilly from his commitment to us due to the grave illness of his father. We had hoped Bill could have been with us longer. You should know that in my opinion, based on 35 years' experience, O'Reilly is the most talented on-the-air anchor with whom I have worked. He is also intelligent, energetic, conscientious, and dedicated to high standards of conduct, both personal and professional. Sincerely, Thomas R. Dargan, Executive Vice President, KATU. Now, that letter humbled me and tempered every bitter thought I had over the unfairness in Portland. You see, sometimes life is like that. When they kick you and there's nothing you can do about it, a white knight rides in. Tom Dargan passed away a few years ago, but his kindness will stay with me for the rest of my life. Life is indeed unfair, and nothing is going to change that. But if we ourselves strive to be fair, things will balance out. I really believe that. It all goes back to Moses and Jesus, doesn't it? Love your neighbor as yourself. When people ask me what drives my fierce work ethic, why I work so hard when I don't have to anymore, I simply tell them that I'm still on a quest to make sure others get treated fairly. In a world that increasingly celebrates selfishness and excessive materialism, I don't do that. I'm with the guys on the front lines in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm with the nuns and priests attending to the poor in Haiti. I'm for the moms and dads working 60 hours a week trying to improve the lives of their children. While I have my forum in the media, those people will be celebrated and get a fair hearing every day. In your life, when the bastards pound you, fight back. But fight back smart. Remember where you came from and figure out where you want to go. Along the way, help everyone you can help. If you do, a knight like Tom Dargan will ride in when you really need one. I guarantee it. Chapter 16, End of Story. Say goodnight, Gracie. George Burns. He's a work in progress. How many times have you heard someone spout that bad cliche? What a cop-out. What it really means is, he's a jerk and might be one forever. So never say that about anyone. We're all flawed. No person on this earth will ever be a completed work. Just had to get that off my chest. Writing this book was difficult for me. As you may know, I don't like to get into a lot of personal stuff. When People magazine interviewed me a few years ago, I pretty much stonewalled on the non-work stuff and wouldn't even let them photograph my daughter's face. That's because, as Boz Scaggs once sang, putting your business in the street is low down. Personal stuff should stay personal. Splattering your life all over the place never works out well. In this book, I tried to stay focused on how my life experiences have shaped my thinking on issues and the pursuit of justice. I hope I've succeeded in that. At the end of all my books, I like to thank the listener. After all, it's a great compliment that you would invest your time and money and energy listening to my story. Truly, I hope some of my adventures clicked with you. I hope you can use some of what's in this book to make things better in your life. Every one of us is on the planet for a purpose. I was lucky enough to find mine fairly young in life, but understanding the full extent of my purpose took much longer. Early in my career, I was not focused on the big picture as I am today. That was natural since I was trying to find my way through the TV jungle and the foliage was dense. But always I reacted when I saw someone treated unfairly. It is that passion more than anything else that has made me successful. Folks can feel it through their television screens. You might not like me, but it's obvious there's a real person looking right back at you. Sometimes, though, he's cranky. Things I Wish I Had Known Earlier. To wrap up this book, I want to dispense a few tips. Calling them words of wisdom would be a stretch, but you may find the following observations amusing. First of all, if you believe in God, you know that the deity has set up life as a series of challenges for us. When we're young, we have great energy, but we're usually stupid. That's what George Bernard Shaw meant when he said youth is wasted on the young. Many of us wise up as we get older, but then naps become a priority. It's just the way it is and always has been. In my fifth decade, I began having conversations with myself. I should have started sooner, but I was too busy talking about myself to figure out that conversing honestly with myself is a much better tool for self-evaluation. So if you see me mumbling while walking down the street, that's what that's all about. And these conversations are tough. Often they're about what I should have done. Monday morning quarterbacking. Hey, meathead, you should have asked Hillary Clinton this. How could you have forgotten to hammer President Bush with that? Questioning yourself sharply keeps the mind sharp. It creates a personal no-spin zone. Make a mistake, identify the reason you made it. Then it's less likely to happen again. Rationalizing is stupid. That's what children do. I can't tell you how many times folks call me on the radio trying to justify bad behavior by pointing to other bad behavior. O'Reilly, how can you blame Iran for killing American soldiers when we supported the Shah in 1956? That kind of nonsense. Another thing I've learned rather late in life is to rehearse stuff. No, not my TV script, but real life. Say you're going on a date. Well, think about the person you'll be with. What are his or her interests? Consider the evening carefully before you begin socializing. Same thing at work. If you have a big event there, think about how you're going to approach it. You don't have to memorize stuff. Just walk your mind through the schedule. You'll be amazed at how much more relaxed you'll become. And as some of us know, a calm mind leads to creativity. Sadly, I didn't do any of that as a younger person. I just barged right in there. I still feel sorry for some of my dates. By the time I actually figured out who they were, it was closing time. Often my self-absorption was truly amazing. Luckily, I was fairly entertaining in a shallow kind of way, so I got away with some foolish behavior. The standard line my friends have about me is, well, you know what he's like. Indeed. But really, it's so easy to look forward and learn from the past. Just talk to yourself once in a while. Level with you. I know that sounds like the title of a dopey self-help book, but it is a worthwhile strategy. Remember the song The Gambler? The key lines were, you gotta know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. Now, I'm not a big Kenny Rogers fan because I can't get past the plastic surgery and the chicken was just so-so, but there's plenty of wisdom in that chorus from his 1978 hit song, especially when it comes to dealing, bad pun alert, with people. Throughout my life, I have known some very great women who have gotten involved with flawed men. The ladies all had one thing in common. They simply would not acknowledge the guy's weaknesses when almost everybody else around them saw the weaknesses clearly. The women either rationalized the bad behavior by saying things like, well, that's just the way Bruno is, or they ignored it entirely. Both responses always led to disaster. Men are another matter. They often let their, well, primitive drives do their thinking, if you know what I mean, and I think you do, as Joe Bob Briggs puts it. For both sexes, the ability to read people is a survival necessity in our complicated world. There's no question about it. But keep in mind a couple of things. Most folks do not change. Hitler was a bad person from the jump. Evil is not acquired. It is enthusiastically embraced by evildoers. For some reason, they enjoy harming people. The dope dealer selling meth or heroin to a kid or even to an adult is not misguided. He or she is evil. When it comes to social concerns or situations, it was rare for my father to offer advice. But he did tell me this: watch how a person treats his mother. If he can't treat her decently, you don't want to know him. You can add this to that. Watch how adults treat children. If a man abandons his child, there's no coming back for him. He's swine. Same thing for a mother. If an adult abuses a kid, nothing can turn that evil around, because damaging a child lasts forever. I'm thankful I always had good instincts when it comes to associating with others. As we've discussed, most of my friends are longtime amigos. Of course, I've made some mistakes in evaluating folks and have paid the price. But when it comes to friends, I've always had high standards, and that has saved me much heartache and betrayal. But know this, I'd rather be alone than be with someone I can't trust. I am comfortable solo. So when someone you know does something wrong, beware. Don't just overlook it. Find out more. And if the conduct continues, quickly cut your losses, even if you're not the target of the bad stuff. Because in the end, a deeply flawed person, one who embraces and excuses bad behavior, will get around to hurting you. The scorpion will sting because it's his nature. Have no doubt. When I was a young guy, I lived on fast food. Burgers, fries, deep dish pizza, and fried seafood dominated my diet. Don't do that. Food affects everything you do and will kill you early if you don't wise up. As a bachelor, I never cooked, never even thought about it. Why cook if Burger King is right over there? So I ate in restaurants all the time, chowing down on whatever tasted good. That meant loads of salt and sugar, not too many Brussels sprouts. Even when I visited Brussels, I avoided the Sprouts. I ate fries. With that diet, it is truly a miracle that I am still walking around. These days, I'm not exactly Jack LaLanne juicing up all my meals, but most of the time, I avoid fast food. And when I do succumb, my stomach punishes me for 2 days. Of course, as a predictable baby boomer, I blame the bad diet of my younger days on my parents. As you may know, boomers are big on laying their bad habits off on mom and dad. In my house, we were big on the Mediterranean diet. Kind of. It was only after I actually traveled to Italy and Greece that I figured out ravioli doesn't always come in a can. And if you order SpaghettiOs in Naples, someone will hit you. Anyway, my folks ate what their folks ate, which was inexpensive food blasted with salt. In the summer, barbecues were big. On Sunday, some kind of roasted meat made an appearance. If Rachel Ray lived in my house, she would have been in tears every day of her life. Above all, there was a routine. The following menu was fairly consistent in the O'Reilly house. Please keep in mind that my mother bought cereal in the economical 10 packs. Sunday. Breakfast. French toast, real maple syrup, bacon, and milk. Lunch. Campbell's chicken noodle soup, tuna sandwich, chips. Dinner. Pot roast, mashed potatoes, Jolly Green Giant peas, ice cream sandwich. Monday. Breakfast. Sugar pop cereal, English muffin, grape jelly. Lunch. Bologna sandwich on white with mustard, chips, cookies. Dinner. Sloppy Joe's. If you don't know, you don't want to know. Tuesday. Breakfast. Sugar, frosted flakes, cereal. Crumb cake, butter. Lunch. Tuna sandwich, chips, cookies. Dinner. Pork chops, noodles, Romanoff, fake cheese on noodles. Canned wax beans. Jello with whipped cream. Wednesday. Breakfast. Rice Krispies cereal with sugar. Entenmann's jelly donuts. Excellent. Lunch. Ham and American cheese on white with mustard. Chips, cookies. Dinner. Hot dogs, baked beans, tater tots. Awful. Chocolate pudding. Thursday. Breakfast. Cocoa Puff cereal. White toast with strawberry jam. Lunch. Olive loaf on white with mustard, chips, cookies. Dinner. Tuna casserole. Green beans or lima beans or string beans. Ice pop. Friday. Breakfast. Cornflakes with sugar. Frozen waffles with real maple syrup. Lunch. Tuna sandwich with lettuce, chips, and cookies. Dinner. Fish sticks, breaded and dreaded. Spaghetti with canned tomato sauce. Saturday. Breakfast. Scrambled egg, sausage, white toast. Lunch. Hot dogs or hamburgers. Dinner. Flank steak, baked potato, beans of some kind, Entenmann's chocolate cake. Extraordinary. Also, there were a variety of Hostess and Drake snacks available in my house, which were often used as bribes to calm down us kids. Big items were ringdings, snowballs, devil dogs, Twinkies, and Hostess cupcakes. Of course, the sugar rush provided by these wastebusters did little to calm down any kid. In fact, they'd keep you up another couple of hours at night. Love them. If it's true that you are what you eat, then I am one sweet guy, simply because of the cereal intake alone. Today, however, I am big on healthy food. Oatmeal in the morning, soups with vegetables for lunch, and non-fried fish for dinner. I've always been a boring guy, and now I am even more so. I still love cheeseburgers, but if I eat one every 5 weeks, that's a lot. Tragically, there are no longer any ringdings in my house. If I could, I'd eat nachos every day, but I can't. I work 60 hours a week, and my fuel has to be premium. Nutritious food is the most important factor in staying healthy. I wish I had known that at age 25, but again, it was my parents' fault that I did not. Perhaps my anti-smoking, anti-drinking posture slightly mitigated the junk food diet. My mother smoked at least a pack a day, so my sister and I became well acquainted with secondhand smoke while sitting in the back seat of the family's Nash Rambler. Combined with the car's extensive exhaust fumes, the clouds of cigarette smoke made it seem like Shanghai back there. But remember, in the 50s and 60s, smoking was expected. If you weren't puffing away, folks in Levittown would wonder what exactly was wrong with you. Even my father would have a Marlboro once in a while, although he never became addicted, as my mother did. As for drinking, there was lots of it among adults in my neighborhood, but my parents were always sober. My mother would have a little wine now and then. My father would drink Peel's beer at dinner. However, my dad made it clear to us that anyone who got drunk was a lush. In my house, that was not a good thing. Of course, most kids in Levittown sneaked cigarettes out of the house and would smoke them in the woods or wherever. I did that for a very short time, but found it boring and truly distasteful. I never cared about being cool, so wasting time puffing on a Winston had zero appeal for me. Therefore, after a few dopey trips to the forest, I banished cigarettes forever. Throughout my teen years, it basically came down to orange soda, Carvel ice cream, and double cheeseburgers. The diet of champions. Since I played four sports, I didn't get fat. Since I played four sports, I didn't get high. But, sad to say, there was nothing the sports could do about my personality. The nuns were fond of saying that cleanliness is next to godliness. But few in my class cared much about that. But the nuns were correct. Grooming is so important in America that I wish as a kid I had been subject to some formal training in it rather than just platitudes. We had one bathroom in my house, and to call it small is to insult Mickey Rooney. Because my father was at heart a military man, daily showers were required. But looking spiffy was not a top priority. And since all my friends looked like me, who even knew what spiffy looked like? Of course, Anne Margaret was plenty spiffy. But hey, that was Hollywood, not Long Island. Most of us in Levittown had pale white complexions topped with bad haircuts, and that was that. Once Elvis appeared on the scene, the haircuts got even worse, and don't even mention the Beatles. It was upon entering Chaminade High School in 1963 that I first saw the flip side of grooming. After phys ed, we were required to take showers. Presto, an astonishing array of grooming stuff appeared in the locker room, thanks to the rich guys. Sprays and gels and lotions were all set in motion. Up to that point in my life, I understood Johnson's baby powder, but that was about it. However, the swell guys had all kinds of exotic personal products and even had nifty little compact leather cases in which to store them. Wow. All men are created equal, but from then on, training makes the difference. Ask any Marine, Navy SEAL, or Army Ranger, and they'll confirm that. My parents were clean and neat, and my father might even slap on a little Aqua Velva or something in the morning. But again, in my house, there was little emphasis on appearance or personal presentation. And again, this is very important in America. So working-class kids like me were behind the grooming curve. I believe this remains the case today all throughout the country. Living in London during the 1969-70 college term drastically altered the bold, fresh guy's presentation. British students typically dressed in Harris tweed jackets and flared trousers. At the time, prices were very low in Great Britain, so my American dorm mate, Edgar Royce, and I cruised Oxford Street for groovy clothes and actually bought some. This was a far cry from May's department store in Levittown. When I returned to Marist College for my senior year, my new wardrobe won me points with some of the co-eds who were used to seeing college boys dressed like gardeners. But you should have seen the looks from my guy friends when I showed up to my marriage and the family class wearing a blue blazer. Priceless. The United States is a great country that honors values and freedom, but many Americans also worship attractive looks. So please understand that appearance and speech are ultra important to achieving success. In my early youth, I spoke with a pronounced New York accent and dressed like one of the dead-end kids. My parents regarded that as a matter of course, simply the natural order of things. But the more quickly you figure out that you will be judged by how you look and how you sound, the easier your life will be. Santana might get away with singing "Ain't Got Nobody That I Can Depend On," but you can't. That is, if you want to work in the lucrative white-collar world. These days, when I go to the beach, I see many young kids covered with garish tattoos and showing off pierced faces. What are their parents thinking? Someday, one of these beach kids might want to earn some decent money by working for the factor. Let me be blunt. A dragon tattoo on your neck is not going to help in that quest. I remain a working-class guy by choice, but my staff has to present itself in a certain way. because we're dealing with some of the most powerful people on Earth. Street smarts are great, but looking like you just got paroled from Sing Sing is not. Life is hard enough. Don't make it more difficult by cutting down your vocational opportunities because you want to look like Eminem. Okay? Finally, I want to tell you one thing I still haven't mastered. Patience. Even though I am successful and supposedly bright, I still let myself get annoyed in certain situations that I should simply disregard. For me, it's all about expectations. If I go to a restaurant, for example, and the service is bad, it ticks me off. I know, I should just let it go. Either leave or tough it out. But no, the bold, fresh guy often has to confront the manager and explain the source of my disenchantment. Usually, I do this quietly, but I still do it. Why? Because it is not the way things should be. Now, I know this is stupid. So what if the steak tartare takes an hour to get out of the kitchen? Actually, I never eat anything tartare. That sounds like a band of ancient Asian marauders. But my point is that bad service is small stuff. And as we all know, you don't sweat the small stuff. But sometimes I do. Jesus would not sweat the small stuff. Neither would Gandhi. They were big stuff guys. Mostly, I try to be a big stuff guy, too. But sometimes I fail. Tardiness also drives me crazy. I should overlook it, but somehow I see it as an insult. Your time is more valuable than mine? I have to wait for you? Of course, things happen, and I'm fine with valid reasons for delay. However, to be late just because you can be eliminates you from my dance card. When I interviewed Senator Hillary Clinton in late April 2008, she was 45 minutes late. Her Secret Service guys told me she's almost always tardy. Of course, I was being well paid to wait for the senator, but I noted the situation. By the way, when Hillary finally showed up, she didn't mention being late at all. Interesting. My father did tend to sweat the small stuff, so like the bad food deal, maybe I can blame him. Perhaps it's genetic. The nuns certainly sweated every little thing. Therefore, I feel comfortable blaming the Catholic Church for my impatience, which I believe is considered a venial sin. Remember, I am a baby boomer, and as noted earlier, we are the absolute best at assigning blame to others for our own failings. In fact, we have honed this technique to a degree never before seen in America. If there's any good in being impatient, it's that it can help at work. The factor staff is quick, no fooling around. When they get an assignment, boom, they're on top of it. Partly that's because they don't want me prodding them with salty language, but mostly it's about pride. We do 3 hours of commentary a day, one on television, two on radio, and almost always meet our deadlines. In my opinion, the factor staff is the gold standard in the TV news industry. Our ratings prove it. For the most part, though, patience is a good thing. Patient people are often kind and accepting of the faults of others. They are soothing people. They like wind chimes and hot tea. Sometimes they live in places like Big Sur, California, where they can look out at the sea and see stuff. They can do this for a long time, as there is no rush. Patience, as someone once said, is its own reward. But I am not patient, and it is primarily my father's fault. I could go on with my story, but as I like to say on the air, enough's enough. You've got it. A bold, fresh piece of humanity fights his way up and becomes a media force. Along the way, he has many adventures and encounters that have shaped his vision and philosophy. If there is a Cliff Notes for this book, I've just summed it up in that paragraph. Again, thanks for taking the time to consider my story. I hope it was a good listen. If it wasn't, tell someone you don't like that it was, so they'll buy the audiobook. Little things like that can bring satisfaction. People always ask me what I do in my spare time. Well, I read, I collect American historical documents, I play some sports. I basically putter around. Chances are, I like the same stuff you like. Sports, the beach, naps, and no spin. For me, there's no $4 cups of coffee. And if there's any fusion involved in my supper, I will leave the table. Of course, in my industry, there are plenty of swells who can't get enough fusion. There's also no shortage of pretentious entitlement. As you know by now, the Bold Fresh Guy does not go for that. On weekends, I eat at my local diners and delicatessens. I talked to guys like the Bear and John Blasey, both of whom I've known since we were 5 years old. I go to church and pray for patience. Also, I say prayers of thanks for the miracle of my life. Not kidding about that. Next time you meet an atheist, tell him or her that you know a bold, fresh guy, a barbarian who was raised in a working-class home and retains the lessons he learned there. Then mention to that atheist that this guy is now watched and listened to on a daily basis by millions of people all over the world and, to boot, sells millions of books. Then, while the non-believer is digesting all of that, ask him or her if they still don't believe there's a God. Sister Lorana would be proud of that challenge to the atheist. I absolutely know that. So, if you really examine it, things have come full circle. The bold, fresh guy is still that way, but now he's that way in front of millions. He's spouting life lessons born of his teachers and of his parents. There's something downright poetic about that, is there not?
This is Bill O'Reilly. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Bold, Fresh Piece of Humanity by Bill O'Reilly. This program was directed by Karen DiMattea, executive producer Dan Zitt. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2008 by Bill O'Reilly. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.